As I pick up these glasses, I'm reminded to make sure they're first century ones. As we want to look at this book of Revelation through the glasses of people living in the first century. And people meaning primarily those Christians living in Western Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. Those people in those churches represented in Revelation 2 and 3, those Christians who were being persecuted severely by the Roman Empire, in particular those authorized to try and enforce emperor worship. And when we, of course, look at Revelation through those eyes, it becomes so much clearer to us what John has been revealed by inspiration and who then is revealing it to us. And it makes so much more sense when we read it through first century glasses. We, in this section, have looked at the seven bowls, seven vials, seven cups of God's wrath. And that wrath, of course, is being poured out on that evil Roman Empire of the first century. The ones responsible for the suffering of His people. Revelation is, for those people in the first century, a positive letter. A letter to comfort them, encourage them, tell them to remain faithful, and that a paradise awaits them. We've seen many sevens in this book, seven angels and seven trumpets and seven vials or seven bowls and many of them representing the completeness, the total. And so when we see these seven vials, we're talking about the total, complete outpouring of God's wrath upon the Roman Empire to an extent that the empire would fall and never rise again. So please be with me as we read Revelation 7:10 and we look at one of the seven angels. Admittedly, Revelation 17 is probably one of the more difficult chapters in the book, but as long as we continue to look at it as we have been, much of it's made clearer. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication." And so here we're introduced to the main subject of this chapter. And that, of course, is the great harlot who sits on many waters. We have been introduced to the great harlot before in many different ways. He says very clearly what the harlot is in a little bit. And so we'll wait sometime here before we identify this harlot, but we see that she is sitting on many waters, and we'll also see later on in this book that those many waters represent all the various nations and peoples and ethnic groups and countries that the Roman Empire had conquered and was over at that time. And so we see this harlot, and we'll see what that she's sitting on a beast here in a minute. And she is controlling all of those nations and peoples and countries. And she has done what? Well, the kings of the earth has committed fornication with her, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Committed fornication with her. All of these countries had formed alliances. And essentially, that's what fornication is, right? It's the formation of an alliance. Whether we're talking about physical fornication or spiritual fornication, it's an alliance. It's a coming together. And so that's what these countries had done, these nations and people. They had formed alliances with Rome. Because they were getting, one reason, they were getting wealthy from her, as we'll see later. So they had done that, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. They had gotten rich off of the the Roman Empire. They had prospered, I guess you might want to say, from this alliance that she had, that they had made together, political alliances, economic alliances, and of course even religious ones as well. And so they were drunk with all the pleasures and all the worldliness that they gained from being part of the Roman Empire. So what happens? So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And let's just stop there before we go any further. Here the woman that was called a harlot is now just called a woman. But we see something else now in this picture John sees. And this harlot, this woman, is sitting on a scarlet beast. A red beast. Very much like the dragon we've talked about before, but here he's just, the term is just called a scarlet beast. And she is filled with names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns, which we'll talk about in a moment. You know, in the Bible, the word wilderness can be used in both a good way and a bad way. Sometimes a wilderness is a place of peace and protection, like the woman we had seen previous in this book, vastly different woman than this one. That woman was in the wilderness in the sense of being at a place of peace and protection. This one's in a wilderness of desolation. Very, very different type of wilderness. And wilderness can have both connotations in the Bible. This one is adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, and we see the worldliness again, this outward adorning of her. And she has a golden cup that's full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And we're going to talk more about that as we go along. This is an interesting book in that this chapter, because he'll mention something in one of the verses, but give details about it later on in the chapter. Instead of giving all the details about it in one place, it's like an unfolding in this chapter. He gives some details, and then he gives more details later on in the chapter. And that seems to be what he does here. And this golden cup is full of wickedness. It's full of sin, destruction, ungodliness, uncleanness, filthiness. And of course, again, we're talking about the Roman Empire and all the suffering that she had caused. Well, we learn more about it. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Now we have this name, like plastered or written on her forehead. We've seen other things in this book written on people's foreheads, right? Several times. We've seen numbers. We've seen names. So it's not unusual. And apparently, harlots in the first century actually did wear something on their forehead. So the people in the first century who were reading this would have this association between a first century harlot and this harlot that he's talking about. He says she is the mother of all harlots and all the abominations of the earth. We've talked about how vile and corrupt and decadent and immoral and wicked the Roman Empire was in the first century. It makes our culture today look mild. That's how wicked it was. Because ours is pretty bad. But you think about one that's far worse. That was the Roman Empire of the first century, the second century. It was very, very wicked and vile and sinful. And so no wonder he calls the Roman Empire, the wickedness of the Roman Empire, Babylon the Great. You know, Babylon in the Old Testament, of course, had the connotation of being an enemy of God's people. Number of places we see that phrase used to represent those enemies of God. And so how fitting it is that the Holy Spirit would use Babylon to represent this wicked, abominable empire. It's so fitting that He would choose that and call it Babylon the Great. And so He says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. And it's not surprising. There's no doubt, if we're reading this with first century glasses, that if we're a Christian in the first century, we know without a doubt who He's talking about. That He's talking about Rome, the city, the Roman Empire. Of course, Rome was the center of the Roman Empire. That's where all the power and authority came from for the whole Roman Empire. That was the seat of authority. So we have this country, this empire, represented by this city, and how wicked it is. And He says that, I saw this woman drunk with the blood of the saints. And by this time, of course, the church had suffered terribly at the hands of Rome and the Roman Empire. They had suffered, they had been killed, they had been martyred. And so it's a very fitting description that He describes this woman drunk, not drunk with wine, but drunk with the blood of Christians in the first century. What a horrible description, but it was a true description. Drunk with the innocent blood of God's people, because God's people were innocent. Roman Empire was filled with joy at this persecution. They were glad to persecute the Christians. They wanted to persecute the Christian. And so in a kind of a symbolic, figurative way, we see Rome, the Roman Empire, drunk with the blood of God's people. And John says, when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Not in a positive way, but he was astonished at how cruel and how immoral and how decadent the Roman Empire was. You know, you can stand in amazement and wonder at something in two different ways. At how wonderful it is and how great it is, or how horrible and how disgusting it is. You know, you can stand in awe and wonder two different ways. Well, it was the latter way that John was viewing Rome and the Roman Empire. At how cruel they were, and how immoral and how wicked and sinful they were. That's why he says, I'm standing in wonder and amazement looking at her. But the angel says, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. These next three or four verses are probably some of the most difficult in the whole book. But if we keep first century Christians in mind, I think we can come to a conclusion about what he's talking about. So the angel is going to reveal to John about this woman and who she is and the beast and the seven heads and the ten horns that's on the beast. So he begins in verse 8 by saying, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here's the mind which has wisdom. See, he says, you can understand this. You can have wisdom. You can know what I'm talking about. Well, he says the seven heads are what? Seven mountains on which the woman sits. Well, if the people hadn't figured out who or what he was talking about, they would have known from this, because there was only one great city that sat on seven mountains in the first century, and that was Rome. It sits on seven mountains. It literally sits on seven mountains. And so they would have identified who he was talking about quite easily. So he says the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, there are also seven kings. Here's where it gets a little more difficult. Now, out of those seven, five have fallen. Five's in the past. Five has came and went. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. So now we've gone from seven to eight, and that's critical, I think. And is of the seven, the eighth one is of the seven, he's like the seven, and he's going to perdition just like the seven are. Let's stop there and identify these seven heads, these seven kings that he talks about. And these seven heads are identified with this beast that is carrying the woman. Well, we've talked about the woman being Rome. The beast that's sitting on, or that is holding her up, is the whole Roman Empire. And of course, the whole Roman Empire was upholding, supporting Rome. So really, those two things are in some ways synonymous. They're completely tied together. To the Christians, it represents all the evil and wickedness and cruelty of the Roman Empire and the ones enforcing emperor worship and that whole imperial Roman government. And how sinful and wicked they were. And so he says there are seven heads, which are seven kings. Five have fallen. Five of them have, we might say, came and went. It's interesting that of these, when we include the eighth, of these eight, there were two that really stood out as being the worst, the most cruel, the ones that had more persecution of Christians than any others. Ones that we've talked about more than any others. Nero and Domitian. Those were the two that were the most wicked and most cruel of all those Roman kings, those Roman emperors. And so Domitian would definitely be the last one. This one that he calls is of the eighth. But they were very wicked people, evil. And he says, those who dwell on the earth will marvel, who? Those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And who are those? Well, they're the people who follow the beast, follow the harlot. So those that he's talking about, Roman emperors, the five that had fallen, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero. They had fallen. They were in the past. They were no longer a part. They were no longer alive. They were no longer active in any sense in the Roman Empire. And they were five main emperors. There were others that only ruled for a very short time that had very little influence on the Roman Empire whatsoever. The one who is would be Vespasian, who we've talked about before in the past. The one who is. Titus, the one yet to come. And Domitian, the one who is the eighth. And he is of the seven, and he's going to perdition. That's all. All of those are headed to perdition, every one of them. But all of those, or out of all of them, Domitian was the worst by far. Every historian, secular or religious, will say the same thing. Domitian was the absolute worst of all the emperors. He spilled more blood of Christians, persecuted more Christians, caused more Christians to suffer than any of them. There were none that were even close to him. The closest would be Nero, who, of course, had came and gone by now. But Nero was awful, was terrible. And we talked before how there was an expectation among people that once Nero died, he was going to be resurrected. And people thought he was resurrected in Domitian, because Domitian was so much like Nero, but then took it even further. Nero was cruel and wicked and sinful and evil. But Domitian was more of of that. He was more wicked and more cruel and caused more suffering. So again, I think if you're in the first century, you're going to recognize, the Christian would, that he's talking about Rome, he's talking about the Roman Empire, he's talking about these Roman emperors and how evil they are. And he says, and when he comes, he must continue a short time, and of course he would continue a short time, talking about the seventh one. Why would we take the seven kings here to be literal? Actually, there's eight. One of the main reasons is five, the symbol five, from what I could find out, is never used symbolically or figuratively in literature, especially in the first century. Three was used quite often, six was, seven was, 10 was, 12 was, five, never. It was always used literally. Why? I don't know. But if we're going to look at how the numbers were actually used in John's day, five would seem to be something you need to take literally. So when we look at those five kings, the ones that we mentioned, it seems like we should consider them to be literal kings, those ones that we mentioned. And so we have Rome, the great harlot, sitting on the beast with the ten heads, or the seven heads and ten horns, being the entire Roman Empire, and we'll talk again more about that in a little bit. And those were the ones who did the most damage to God's people. Mainly Nero and Domitian, but Domitian more than any of the others. There was a short period of time, especially during Titus's time, the one who is, when there was very little persecution of Christians. So there was a short time period of a few years there in between Nero and Domitian where Christians didn't have much persecution. It was mild. It was very severe under Nero, very severe under Domitian. But especially during Titus's time and maybe Vespasian's, because those two were very, very close together, that there was not very much persecution. But when Domitian comes along, the persecution was just unreal. So this eighth beast, this eighth king, this eighth emperor, then the last one he calls a beast. He calls the seven kings, but then he calls the eighth one a beast. I think the reason for that is because he was the worst. He was definitely the worst. And that really, I think, fits chronologically. It fits the text. It fits what I would have expected if I was in the first century. It fits all of those things. So in verse 11, when he says, the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, is going to perdition, we'll be talking about Domitian. The worst of all of those Roman emperors, the worst of all of those Roman kings, the worst that ever reigned in the Roman Empire. Well, he says in verse 12, going on with the same idea, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Now we're seeing, I think the term would be vassal kings. These were nations and countries and peoples that Rome had conquered, that the Roman Empire had given power to for a short period of time. That's going to come back and haunt them later in this chapter. But they had been given some power, and it was for a short time, and they get it from the beast. That's where the power actually came from. And he says, of these ten horns, which are ten kings, these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. See, they're attached to Rome. Rome is what feeds them and gives them power and gives them authority. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. First century glasses are on. That's going to be encouraging to me. It tells me, as a Christian in the first century, that all of those kings and all of those nations that are warring against you through the Roman Empire, they are going to be defeated by Christ. Why? Because those people are called, they're chosen, and they're faithful. The Lamb is the one who is Lord of lords and King of kings. It's not the Roman emperors. It's not any of those other kings. It's the Lamb. Well, he says to me, "The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues." See, I said he gives you a partial picture at the beginning of the chapter and then gives you more information later. We saw that harlot over all the waters. Well, he says those waters are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And of course, the Roman Empire included so many different types and of people and nations and tribes and so forth, all kinds. And so again, we're told more specifically who this harlot has to be. It has to be this Rome, which is, you know, the capital of the entire Roman Empire. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot. Now they were working for the harlot. They were with the harlot. They were getting power and authority from the harlot. Now it says they're going to turn on the harlot. They're going to hate the harlot. They're going to hate the Roman Empire. They're going to make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Why? For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill His purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. These nations, these vassal nations that Rome had conquered and were part of the Roman Empire, they were all one day going to turn on the Roman Empire. And of course they did historically. Again, you go back and read Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Rise and Decline of the Roman Empire, and that's one of the things that actually happened to the Roman Empire. But that happens a lot when a nation will go in and conquer other peoples. Those peoples will, nations will become a thorn in the flesh to that conquering nation and will turn on them. Well, that's what it says is going to happen to the Roman Empire. They were going to turn on Rome, and they did. That was one of the reasons for the fall of the Roman Empire. There were a number of reasons why it fell that we've talked about in the past. Enemies from without, natural disasters, and then that moral decadence, that corruption from within, all of those things brought down the Roman Empire. But it says the reason that happened is God has put it into their hearts to fulfill His purpose. I'm sure none of those nations thought they were doing God's will when they turned on Rome. But the Bible says it was God's will. God was behind it. It doesn't say how he accomplished that, and it's not for us to know, but we do know that they were fulfilling God's purpose. That's what it says specifically. They were fulfilling God's purpose, so he was behind it. He was behind the fall of the Roman Empire. You know, there are all these reasons, but it is ultimately God that brought down the Roman Empire. Why is he telling it to these Christians? To comfort them. Because they were the ones that were being persecuted and would be for several years severely persecuted. So he's telling them, this Roman Empire is not going to be around very long. He says, I'm going to bring it down one way or another. From without, from within, it's going to come down. It's going to be destroyed and it's never, ever going to exist again. And that would be very comforting. So when I put on these first century glasses, it makes sense what he's talking about. That Rome, the great harlot, is on the beast, the Roman Empire, and God's going to bring it down. He's going to destroy that harlot, that beast, in a number of ways. While the two worst were Nero and Domitian, they were all going into perdition because of all they had done to God's people. And he ends by saying, and the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Well, how many great cities in the first century were reigning over the kings of the earth? One. There's no way to mistake what he's talking about. There was only one city reigning over the kings of the earth, the nations of the world, and it was Rome. It's not some nation in the future. It was Rome of the first century. That's who was reigning over the kings of the earth. There's no way to mistake that. No way to make that something else if we're reading it like we should. Does this have anything to do with us today? Not near as much as it had to do with the people in the first century. You know, this is what you hear. Well, if this is mainly to comfort people in the first century, what does it have to do with us? Well, not near as much as it did them. You know, people today want to have revelation all about them, all about what's going to happen to them and do for them. That's not why Revelation was written. It offers us a lot of comfort. Number one, it tells us God is in absolute control. And that He's going to bring down all the evil nations and people that are persecuting His people. He'll bring them down in one way or another. He's going to do that. But it was written for those people in the first century who were undergoing the worst persecution in history. It was for them. We learn a lot of principles from it. One is, we need to be part of the called, the chosen, and the faithful. Yes, we're called, as we mentioned this morning, by the gospel. The gospel calls us to be converted, calls us to be born again. The Bible tells us that there are chosen ones, not chosen randomly. God, before the foundation of the world, chose how He was going to save people, which we also talked about this morning. And only those people who are called, chosen, and faithful, remain faithful, will get to be with the Lamb forever. Those who are converted, those who are born again, those who are immersed, and those who remain faithful. So tonight, as we sing this song, we need to think about, are we part of the called and chosen and faithful? God is calling, and He's calling you now. And if you want to respond, I encourage you to do that as we stand and sing.